All right. So right now I'm joined with Professor Jared Ball. He is a professor of communication studies at Morgan State University. Thank you very much for giving your time to do the interview, Jared.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you. Now, what I wanted to talk to you about and what this interview is about is sort of talking about the Obama presidency so far and some of the criticisms and other things that are surrounding it. So, I mean, during the Barack Obama's campaign and then after his inauguration, there was this kind of this feeling of euphoria. Now, kind of 3 years later, that euphoria has kind of given way to a lot of frustration and criticism. What is your response to this frustration and criticism? What is your opinion of this?
Well, I mean, it's predictable. And I and at least a handful of others had said this would be the case and have been saying it for quite a number of years now, that this would be the case, that the corporate nature of Obama's candidacy and certainly his campaign and now certainly his presidency has sort of predetermined that the people who invested so much hope and praise in him initially would be disappointed by now, because it was clear to me and again some others that there was no way he was going to do any of the things that he either never said but was given credit for having said, or in some cases did say that he was going to do, so we were clear he was going to extend war, increase the military budget, give away what have now been, and I don't know that we predicted this much, but that he has given away more public financing and support to Wall Street than any other point in history, which stands to reason. He was the most heavily funded corporate candidate in U.S. political history. So we knew that this would be the case, and we knew that from the perspective of from the racial perspective, from the black perspective, that it would be clear that he would not be able to affect any major change in the conditions of black people, in the relationship black people have to the society, and he has certainly not made any improvements there, nor has he made any improvements, real substantive improvements in terms of working people and other so-called oppressed minorities and so on. So, again, it was predictable, unfortunately, that the disappointment that many now feel would be the case. The question for us has always been, what would that disappointment lead us to? And I think that's the question that we have to ask now. Will it lead to greater levels of organization and progressive movement building, or will it sort of lead to further depression and apathy, or disaffection and more confusion and delusion? And that's what I think we have to struggle with right now.
Yeah, but kind of talking more to the racial aspect of this, obviously, him being the first black president, there was a lot of that, talked about in the mainstream media. But it's interesting, I remember hearing someone, I forget now where I heard this, but I distinctly remember it because I found it so shocking. Someone said, "Well, with Obama in the presidency, we're now in the post-racial America," and it was, that's shocking to hear that. Suddenly, he's going to also wipe out racism,
Right.
But also connected with that was the connection between him and Martin Luther King Jr. And that history and the kind of the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. In many ways, I think the media definitely grabbed onto that, as well as I think his campaign. So talk a bit about that dynamic of him kind of closing up with a certain version of Martin Luther King Jr.
Well, that's certainly one part of this problem. I mean, the popular version of Dr. King has been so distorted that it speaks against the man himself. And to that to the extent that that has been successful, and I think it's been greatly successful, he is re-assassinated almost annually in image, so that no one can, or so that few people at least are encouraged to really pick up the work and the analysis that he had developed at the end of his life. And that distortion allowed for many people to be confused into thinking and tricked into thinking, because as you said, the Obama campaign did pick up on this, that Obama was an extension of the movement that King represented. And the two couldn't be more diametrically opposed. Obama is a product, again, of Wall Street, of the right-wing element of the Democratic Party. He was vetted beginning in the 90s to be a candidate, as Paul Street has written, that was black but not civil rights black, and who would support and be friendly to Wall Street and to the militarist elements of the national political elite and so on and so forth. So, but because he is very skillful and talented, and we can't discount good looking, he has been able to, in a very skillful and artful way, attach himself to the legacy of Dr. King in a very empty but quite successful branding campaign. And we have to remember that the advertising community awarded Obama with the brand of the year in 2008. He beat out Nike and Apple as the most successful brand, and this is precisely what was being done. So we would hear allusions to King in his speeches and in Obama's speeches, but none of the substance and none of the sort of biting criticism of capitalism, of militarism, of white supremacy, of white liberals and the black bourgeoisie that Dr. King had targeted at the end of his life. So that has allowed, again, for Obama to adorn himself in a movement that he is not a part of, that he is politically opposed to, and then ride that crest into the White House and then do exactly what his sponsors wanted him to do. And that's why we see what we've seen and why so many people have to now acknowledge themselves as being disappointed. And it is very much what Cynthia McKinney said shortly after the election, that people were going to have buyer's remorse, and that's what they have. The item that they paid so much for, struggled so hard to get elected, has turned on them and not fulfilled their hopes, dreams, in even the slightest way.
Yeah. Kind of more to talk about this branding. Maybe give some of your analysis as to why, the connection was made in the first place. I mean, is it, just the conveniency of it is that, like you talked about, Martin Luther King is brought out every year and, as you put it, reassassinated. But I'm curious, and I want you to kind of go a little bit more into that, an analysis of why this connection. Is it just because he Martin Luther King gives everyone warm fuzzies in a sense, and that's what Obama was trying to get after? What's your take on that?
Well, yeah, that reassassination of image that Dr. King has suffered every day since his physical assassination. First we have to remember that at the time he was killed, Dr. King was hated by this country. The political elite hated him. The civil rights establishment hated him. Certainly the media elite hated him, and they let us know that. I mean, they described him as a buffoon. They said his speech against Vietnam, I think in Time magazine it was, where they said that it was pretty much it could have been just a transcript from Hanoi. The Washington Post said he was a threat to national security and a Leninist, and too friendly with Stokely Carmichael and other black power rights. So they hated Dr. King. And the civil rights leadership, including Andy Young and Jesse Jackson and many others, were uncomfortable with Dr. King's positions against Vietnam and against capitalism and against, as he said, the edifices that cause beggars, and the greatest purveyor of violence being his own country. I mean, they were not fans of where he was going, and he had been threatened numerous times by folks in and out of the movement that if he continued to press those issues, that the struggle for civil rights would suffer. But since his assassination, he's been repackaged into someone that the state could use and that the political elite could use to give the kind of face to so supposed civil rights changes and advances that have taken place, and to sort of take the teeth out of what Dr. King was saying, and certainly to take us away from the fact that King himself said that the civil rights struggle to that point had been the equivalent of rushing the football to the 50-yard line and claiming touchdown, which, given what's going to happen tonight and this weekend, I think is perfectly appropriate as an analogy. So what really happens, because Dr. King was such a major figure, he can't be omitted. It's too difficult to leave him out of the narrative altogether, so he has to be reframed and repackaged into something else. And then, of course, you can't be the first president, the first black president, or first so-called serious black presidential nominee and not pay some tribute to Dr. King, even in a distorted fashion. So, and that's what many people were really looking for. I think many well-intentioned voters for Obama were looking for a Dr. King, even if they were misunderstood what Dr. King or who Dr. King really was. That was what they were looking for, someone who was going to lead a major shift, a major change, a major improvement. So he had to. Obama and his campaign, quite rightly and from their perspective and quite adeptly and skillfully, had to and did use King's assassinated image to promote their own again their own misappropriated, misimaged, inappropriately imaged, inaccurately imaged, and branded campaign. And this is again why. And then, of course, Obama did have to take pot shots at Dr. King during his acceptance speech for the Nobel Peace Prize. He had to dismiss Dr. King as someone who didn't understand world politics and didn't understand a world of terrorism, as if walking through the streets of Mississippi and Tennessee under death threats from the FBI and the Klan isn't enough of an experience with terrorism. But he had to distance himself because he knew that he was now treading on those more heightened levels, the heightened lines of contradiction between him and King, a man who was advocating more war and bombing more people, being associated with peace and with a man of peace like Dr. King, had to rebrand and both associate himself with and distort King and his image himself. Because again, King was produced and almost forcibly produced by the movement. He was almost, it was demanded of him that he assume the position he did as leader of that struggle, where Obama, in quite the opposite fashion, was brought in and promoted by the exact opposite forces, the corporate, militarist, liberal, bougie elements of society that Dr. King was struggling to overthrow. That's the group that promoted Obama, and that's why several of us, and unfortunately not enough of us, were trying to publicly raise this as a point of concern, that you cannot claim to honor King and the movement that produced him while then excitedly voting for a man who was sponsored by the very forces that King was trying to eradicate, simply because that man has a relatively similar complexion. And that's the trick that has been played on black people and people all around the world, even well-meaning white people. And this is what we're all suffering under now. Now, the question again from me is, are we going to organize the alternatives and the movements and the other political parties, or are we going to just continuously vote for the lesser of two evils and accept disappointment? By the way, King, as a Du Boisian, was not only an advocate of though he didn't say it in these words, an advocate of socialism, but he was also an advocate of the talented 10th, or as Du Bois himself called for, a smaller group, the guiding 100 of so-called black successful professionals to go back and help improve the conditions of black America. And Du Bois himself, at the end of his life, said we need to organize a movement of non-voting, actually, to break this sort of this system as he defined it already in the 1950s that had become the you know, two wings of an evil political party. So if we're really going to follow King, we really have to follow and acknowledge the work of Du Bois, and if we're really going to do all of that, then we have to be doing and organizing many different things than we're doing than we are currently. And none of those things would include supporting anymore the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, and certainly not supporting an imperial, neo-colonial, violent, hostile president like Barack Obama.
And on that note, kind of looking forward to this election and what's going to happen, because, you know, like we were talking about, a lot of people are very frustrated and just sort of, maybe not depressed is the word, but kind of, I guess, feeling kind of hoodwinked with this whole thing. I was also reading too that a lot there's, I mean, in the labor movement, there's a lot of people saying, well, why should we bother even going with these Democrats who have essentially allowed this austerity to be rained down upon us, specifically unions? There's talk about maybe the labor movement being independent of the Democratic Party, which is actually a conversation that's been going around for a long time. But so with all this happening moving forward, what is the left kind of progressive people? What are they going to do? What are there movements right now that show some promise, or are these things still need to be built?
I think they still need to be built. I mean, there are some things that give me some inspiration and hope, like the Black Is Back Coalition. I see a major mobilization taking place in October that's supposed to install permanent encampments of protesters, a la King's calls in 1968, and things like that. But I'm not aware, at least, of anything that is more well organized and prepared to assume the political leadership. And that's what I think we still need to build. And part of that, I think, has to come from people not being fed up and giving up, but being fed up with business as usual, and being willing to put their energies and efforts in other places, and stop being tricked into or cajoled into acceptable forms of behavior by threats of, well, we can't let Sarah Palin win, or we can't let the Republican win. At this point, I think we're well past those kinds of silly ploys. I would hope we would be, at least. But so I honestly don't know what progressive and well-meaning people are going to do. I'm not entirely sure. And even individually, I'm not entirely sure what I'm going to do, other than I know I'm not going to be voting for either of the two major parties. But similar to some of my comrades in the Malcolm X grassroots movement, I think that there needs to be a refocus of energy away from electoral politics in general. I think there's been too much of an emphasis on voting as a mechanism of change, as opposed to many other forms of protests that I think need to be engaged or re-engaged. But I'm not entirely sure, other than to say that we need to do something else. I mean, again, just under just while he's been president, the gaps in wealth have worsened. The gap between white and black income has worsened. Black unemployment has reached, or long-term unemployment has reached, levels that haven't been seen since 1948. He's bombing African nations, increasing the military budget. Black access to health care has diminished in the last year, as one report recently showed. So, I mean, things are getting worse under Obama, and the idea that it's just slightly worse than the worst it would be under a Republican president is just such a low standard to start from, an unacceptable standard for me, that I think we need to do something else. What that something else is, or what those something else's are, I'm not entirely sure, but other alternatives have to be developed, and none of them have been developed to, I think, an adequate level of strength at this point. So, I don't know.
Yeah, also thinking, as much as people, being frustrated, but then not wanting the status quo, and then you kind of touched upon, the line of, well, you don't want these Republicans coming in because it's going to get worse. At the same time, when you look at some of these people running for the Republican nomination, the prospect of some of these people having a good shot at the presidency is actually quite, for any progressive left-wing kind of person, is probably pretty scary. What do you think about that dynamic of just,
I've kind of come to where my senior colleague at Black Agenda Report has come, Glenn Ford. I think he makes a great point,
mm-hmm.
that could a Republican president have gotten away with some of the things that Obama's getting away with? I don't know. Could a Republican president get away with the D-plus grade Obama got from the Institute for Southern Studies when they graded his response to Katrina since he's come into office? I mean, he's done nothing for the people of New Orleans. Hey, could a Republican president get away with the $16 trillion Wall Street giveaway that Obama has gotten away with? Could a Republican president have gotten away with an increase in the military budget, with an increase in bombings in Yemen and Pakistan and Somalia and now Libya? You know, could a Republican president, could a white male Republican president have gone to Ghana and said that African suffering is the result of African corruption and not the result of Western imperial business practices? You know, I don't think so. I don't think that would have would a Republican president see such a limited and weak activist response to these kinds of policies? I don't think so. And I think this is the point that Wall Street knew back when it was vetting Obama in the early to mid 90s, that if you put a skillful, good-looking, brilliant black face on what you're doing, much of the left will find itself, cut out from beneath it, find the ground cut from beneath it. And that's what has been going on. There's been, now it's starting to rebuild now, I think. There's starting to be some slow shifts in the other direction. But even those slow shifts are just getting us back to what is already, I think, an insufficient point of departure to begin with. Mm-hmm. So the kind of radical movement building that I think needs to exist didn't exist even under Bush, but was still much, so we aren't even back to the levels of Bush era left-wing organizing under Obama. So, I don't know. At this point, I'm not moved by that. I'm not moved anymore by this really a threat from the liberal left that they throw at us, saying that if it's your fault that Bush won in 2000, because you voted for Nader, or it'll be your fault so-and-so gets in, blah, 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 while discounting, of course, that Bush stole both elections, and also discounting the fact that if we fought and died for the right to vote, we should be able to place that vote wherever we want, and the purpose of voting, at least theoretically, is to achieve power. And if you're only going to vote for those that one wing of the corporate world wants you to vote for versus another, you'll never have power. So it really is a disservice to the men and women who gave it all for the right to vote, to simply cast a vote for the lesser of two evils, when you know going in, especially now, that Obama and the Democratic Party won't make any real change. And remember, Obama had a Democratic majority in the House and the Senate for the first 2 years of his presidency, and we got nothing. So this idea that the Republicans and the right wing are holding him back and this and that and blah, 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 is all absolute mythology and discounts the reality of who Obama was and is to begin with. And he has never been a progressive. He has always been a Wall Street corporate right wing capitulator, and he still is. So I'm not moved by that argument anymore. And I think that if the more people claim to be progressive and radical and want real change, then the more they're going to have to take certain risks, and those risks include helping develop alternative electoral options. But like I said, we need to move beyond that as well, that it's not just all about the vote, and many more things need to be, plans and strategies need to be developed and implemented if we're going to see any real progressive, positive change in the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll have to leave it there, but thank you very much, Professor Jared Ball, for coming on and discussing this. It's actually some very, very important information that you packed into about 20 minutes. There was a whole history lesson you gave there. That's excellent. Thank you very much. Just give the listeners some information of where they can find, if they want to, more of your writings or information, where they can access that.
They can, online, you can find me in any number of places. Mixwhatilike.com is sort of the central home now. And we encourage folks to, they can check us out there. And I certainly want to encourage people to buy my new book of the same title, I Mix What I Like, A Mixtape Manifesto, the royalties from which all go to help political prisoners. And I think it's a small but positive contribution to the development and encouragement of radical ideas and political organization and action. So I mixwhatilike.com is one place to find me, and it's not, you know, other than that, I'm not hard to find, and folks are interested, and I thank you for the time, and I appreciate this discussion.